Call to order the Conference Committee on House File 474. And we're going to start with a side-by-side walkthrough and then take public testimony. And then some discussion. We don't expect that we will finish today. We expect that we will listen to concerns and input and then come back on another day to try and resolve any issues that are brought forth this morning. So Ms. Pontius has another commitment, so we're going to have Mr. Gehring go through the side-by-side for us. I'm also informed that Senator Limmer may join us to discuss particular sections of the bill that he's concerned with. So, Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, so I'm going to do a walkthrough of the side-by-side, and we don't have a formal summary prepared, although Ms. Levholtz did a handout that should be in your packet if you want to follow along with that handout. So I'll be working off the actual side-by-side document with the bill text. So on page R1 of the side-by-side, the first section is a Senate-only section. This is a section that requires that government entities prepare an inventory of surveillance technology that's maintained and used by the government entity. And this inventory list is required to be submitted to the legislature by January 15th of each year. And it would be submitted to the committees with responsibility over data practices issues. My understanding, this is a piece of language that is an amendment from Senator Limmer in the Senate. There's no House companion section to that section. Also on page R1 is House Section 1. This is a section that comes from a separate bill, Representative Holbrook's, that regulates data breaches. And this language, a number of other pieces of language in the side-by-side, come from a bill that's also in a different conference committee currently. So we'll hear it in both places, I guess. House Section 1 on page R1 is a requirement that responsible authorities establish procedures for ensuring that not public data are only accessible to persons whose work assignment reasonably requires access, and then also develop procedures including model policies governing access to data if data is shared with another entity. Starting at the bottom of page R1 and then mostly on page R2 is House Section 2, which is modifying Section 13.055, which is the data breach section. Under current law, there's a data breach procedure in law for data breaches at a state agency. The section would expand that to cover all government entities, including local governments. At the bottom of page R2, Subdivision 2, there's an additional investigation report that would be required to be posted in the event of a data breach at a government entity. On page R3, subdivisions 3 and 4 are conforming changes that, as I mentioned, expand the scope of the data breach section from just state agencies to all government entities under the Data Practices Act. On page R4, Section 3 on the House side is an expansion of the penalties under the Data Practices Act to include penalties, criminal penalties for persons whose conduct constitutes the knowing unauthorized acquisition of not public data, and then also expands a penalty that would apply to a public employee for any action that would be subject to a criminal penalty, including the knowing unauthorized acquisition of not public data, and the public employee could be subject to suspension without pay or dismissal for any of those actions. At the bottom of page R4, House Section 4 and Senate Section 2 is sort of the meat of the license plate reader sections. So on the House side, the House defines lines 4.23 to 4.25, defines the term automated license plate reader data. And on the Senate side, the Senate defines the term automated license plate reader. You can see that on lines 2.1 to 2.5. On lines 2.6 to 2.8 on the Senate side, the Senate defines automated license plate reader data as confidential data if the data are active criminal investigative data. on page R5 at the top of the page on the House side, lines 4.26 to 4.31. The House classifies license plate reader data as private data or non-public data, and then provides that the data is prohibited from being retained unless there is a hit that suggests that the data is showing the identity of a vehicle or license plate that has been stolen, or there's a warrant for the arrest of the owner of the vehicle, or the owner has a suspended or revoked driver's license, or the data are active investigative data. So unless one of those circumstances exists in the House language, the data are prohibited from being retained. The Senate has a little bit more complex structure because partly because the Senate's language provides for some retention of the data. So there is a classification of private or non-public data for certain types of license plate reader data, including license plate numbers, the date, time, and location of data, location data on vehicles, and then also pictures of license plates, vehicles, and areas surrounding the vehicles. The Senate language, starting on line 2.14, provides that these data must be destroyed within 90 days of the time of collection of the data, unless it's active criminal investigative data, but then also includes an allowance for a program participant in the Safe at Home program to request that the data be destroyed immediately. Towards the bottom of page R5, starting on House line 4.32, and Senate line 2.24, both the House and the Senate require that law enforcement agencies maintain a log of license plate reader use. There are some generally sort of stylistic differences in the way that these two sections are structured. One sort of substantive difference is that the House requires the log to include all locations at which the reader is installed or used, which you can see on line 5.1. And on the Senate side, the Senate only requires the log to include readers that are used at a stationary location, which you can see at line 2.29 to 2.30. Both the House and the Senate both require a biennial audit of data collected from license plate readers. On the House side, a responsible law enforcement agency is required to conduct the audit, and on the Senate side, the Department of Public Safety would conduct the audit. Additionally, on the Senate side, the language requires that the law enforcement agency maintain records showing the date that data are collected and whether the data are classified either as private data or as confidential data, as provided earlier in the bill. You can see this language on the Senate side on lines 2.32 to 2.34. On page R6 at the top on the House side, the House requires that law enforcement agencies implement policies and procedures necessary to ensure compliance with the requirements of license plate readers as provided in the bill. The Senate has a little bit more expansive language here. Starting on Senate line 3.3 through 3.17, the Senate requires that certain sections of the Data Practices Act apply to the operation of license plate readers. This includes the data breach notification sections and then requirements that the government entity and law enforcement agency have data protection and security policies in place. And then the Senate also includes language requiring that the law enforcement agency have written procedures to ensure that law enforcement personnel have access to the data only if authorized in writing by the chief sheriff or the head of the law enforcement agency, and that the access to the license plate reader data is for a specific law enforcement purpose. The Senate, starting on line 3.10 on R6, also requires law enforcement agencies that install or use a license plate reader to notify the BCA within 10 days of installation or current use of the reader. Then requires the BCA to maintain a list of law enforcement agencies that have these systems in place, including the locations of stationary license plate readers, except to the extent that it would reveal security information, and then this list would be required to be posted on the BCA's website. The Senate also has an effective date that provides that data that was collected before the section is enacted must be destroyed no later than 15 days after the effective date if the policy substance of the bill would require that the data be destroyed to begin with. And then finally, the last House standalone section is House Section 5, starting at the bottom of page 6 and running onto page R7. This is language that requires the names of law enforcement agencies that submit data to the CYBRS database and the general description of the types of data submitted to be public data. Madam Chair, that's the end of the side-by-side.
All right, thank you. Mr. Gehring, are there any questions for Mr. Gehring? I have a question for the Senate on the issue of stationary readers, and I might have missed it. Is that defined somewhere that it has to be? I mean, what constitutes a stationary reader? There for 24 hours, there for more than a week?
No, Madam Chair, the way we look at it is a stationary reader are those that are designed to be a stationary reader. Like, for an example, in North Minneapolis, I think they have a stationary reader where it just stays there, that's on, like, the Lowry Bridge. And that's different from, let's say, a mobile unit where there may be one in a police car versus there's another unit where it's not necessarily in the police car, but they move them to different locations. So I can't recall, and I'll double check if we have it defined, but I thought we attempted to, and we can hear some testimony from law enforcement to really break down those three notions of stationary, something that can be moved, a license plate reader that can be moved around versus a license plate reader that is mounted in a motor vehicle.
And looking at page R5, on the Senate language, lines 2.29 and 230, it says for a reader at a stationary location. So as I read that, it didn't seem to reflect a type of reader, but a type of use. So I'm a little concerned how we would dissect that.
Yeah, so Madam Chair, that would be great for law enforcement to make a note of that when they come up to talk to us about it, that they can bifurcate that.
Right, great, thanks. I know Mr. Neumeister's time is short this morning, so he wants to testify, so I, at his request, have said that he can go first this morning. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, thank you for the few moments of your time, and thank you. I took off work, and my employer allowed me to do this to go over a very important item. Mr. Chair and conferees, Madam Chair and conferees, my name is Rich Neumeister. I am an open government and privacy advocate and have done a fair amount of work on this particular use of LPRs and also in general on use of technology by government, and particularly of law enforcement, through data requests, discussion with people nationally and all that. I'm very familiar with the aspects of LPR. So my presentation is going to be based on handouts that I've given to you to give you more information so you can make good public policy. Number two, depending on where you all go, as some suggestions. And three, just how important this is. Let's look at Section 1 of the Senate side. I believe this is an important section to do. Madam Chair and members of the conferees, you are very familiar with two issues. One is that it's only 4 years later, 5 years later almost, that the legislature is basically dealing with LPR technology. And it was only last year that Minneapolis Police Department decided to have a written policy on LPR. Bottom line is new technology is coming and compromising people's rights and civil liberties, and you, the legislature, do not know about it. The other example is the issue of stingray kingfish, particularly the one by the Department of Public Safety. Over $600,000 of public monies was used to purchase a stingray. In 2005, this started. And it was only based on folks like myself and others where all of a sudden you are aware of this, and another separate piece of legislation is moving as part of that. It's more expansive, but it tries to deal with that situation. So I very much encourage the House to accept that Senate language. There might be some little enunciations, But if you're going to adopt that, I also encourage, because, as you may know, there is now a new legislative commission that deals with technology and privacy. I don't know the formal name of it. So the report should also go to there. And whatever the report is, that should be public. Now, the rest of the bill, that the crux of this conference committee, the key issue is the 99% of people scanned by Minnesota LPRs, which I contend we may have 75 to 100 at this point, don't know yet, might be more, scanned by Minnesota's LPR cameras are innocent and law-abiding Minnesotans. So what should the restrictions be, and how long should law enforcement be able to retain scans that are not hits and collected on innocent people? And what should those robust safeguards and effective oversight be? And so with that, I will now start to go into the aspects of the bill. And then with the handouts. So I do believe you begin on, I apologize. Okay. One on one and two. So if we go on R4, and this is where the LPR language starts. I prefer the House language on this. It's the definition of what data is. Now, like I've said, I've shared with you, I've looked at a number of states and policies that have been done on the local level. Some of the policies on the local level, like Minneapolis and one or two others I've seen, they have broken down the kind of data that is collected from the LPR. And I'll go further into that on the next page. But I want to go over to the Section 2 now in the definition of the Senate. They have what is known as investigative purposes, which is very broad, and I think there can be some mischief with that. As you may know, I've sent each of you as conference committee members a two-page handout of my views on this, and I either hand-delivered it to you or emailed you a copy of that. If you don't have one of those, I can give it to you, and I know that some folks have that. So on lines 2-5, for investigative purposes. Now the issue of the purpose, now we're going to go on to R5 on the House language, 4 through 2-6 through 431. It's very specific because you got to remember that there's a match. So what you have, for example, and if you go to your handout, you'll see that I gave you a four-page item that explains about LPRs. This is, again, from one of my data practices requests. I got four or five handbooks on different LPR models. I wasn't going to give you 180 pages of it. But what I've given to you is a four-page thing that gives you an idea what people who do this technology, what they're suggesting for law enforcement to use. So what happens, basically, you take a picture of a plate and surrounding area, then it's matched up with some type of database, which currently in Minnesota, there are two basic kinds of databases. Primarily, most law enforcement agencies in my research are using, if you go to the next handout, one of the handouts, which is called, which has little BCA on top. This is the Minnesota license plate data file, which the House language is very specific. So, if you're going to use LPRs in Minnesota, you're going to have to match it with this database and this database only. This is how I read the House language, which defines the purpose and very much defines the use. And also, you'll see more specifically in there, it's for stolen cars, those kinds of things. Now, you'll see this broad list, which is almost, this was like from 2 or 3 years ago. It might be 500,000 files, but right now it's 400,000 files, approximately. You have BCA folks here who might be able to tell you what really the actual number is. So, they match this particular data set, Can you imagine what the LPR, based on with the driver's license and name, and then what happens will be spit out some type of alert. Now, the issue is, as you can see, there's warrants in there. That probably is an active criminal investigation. There are other things in there. Let's say there's an order of protection on me. That will also be an alert. So the issue is you have two different kinds of data sets now based on the alert. And that's why I think it's important to have some type of definition of the different kinds of sets there are. And I've talked with some of you about that. So what happens with the alert? I, Joe, police officer, what am I going to do with that alert? Some of them will be criminal investigations. They're looking for someone, a suspicious person, whatever it may be on this data set. But the other stuff is, yeah, Rich Neumeister, who is maybe have an order of protection on him, was in 8 places over the last 6 months or whatever. That is kind of some of the issues that come into play. So my suggestion to you as policymakers is go with the House language specifically on the data set because it defines the purpose more. Right now, locals can do almost any kind of data sets they want. Hennepin County has 17 separate data files. I've been trying to get what those are, but again, time, I don't have all that time to do that. And so, and that's why it's important to deal with some of these things. Now, it's very, if you go back to R4, on page R4, section 2, lines 2.6 through 2.8. Again, another distinct difference between the House and Senate language. Individuals on 2.7, on individuals or protected non-public data, if the data are or become active criminal investigation. As I stated to you in a letter that I referred to, which all of you received a copy of, is that there can be some mischief here. It's important for definition. Because what can happen in this kind of situation, this goes back, and for Senate conferees, the House members had a hearing through the Chair Lesch's Civil Law Committee for about 3 hours on this whole issue of technology and LPRs. One of the questions was asked of Chief Hartel was, basically, and Mr. Lesch, Chair Lesch can do his own comments on this, is why do you want to do LPRs? Why do you want to retain? And her comment basically was, we don't know what we don't know. So in that kind of thinking, based on the Senate language, and knowing data practices and my experience with law enforcement and other entities, and what Los Angeles and some other entities are doing across the country, well, every car is under investigation. So therefore, everything is confidential. And so I encourage you to take out that language or become. It's very clear, it's very defined, and it helps, again, in public scrutiny and in the accountability of this kind of system. The other thing that I would like to just talk about is there are some differences between... And if there's any questions,
I'm sorry.
Please let me know.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Neumeister. I appreciate your going over the bill with us. I just wanted to ask you a question. So if we took the section out, or the 2.6 through 2.7, it says that it's confidential data. What's the inverse of that? Is that what you're saying? We should take that section.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I suggest or become. Take out the words or become.
Online 2.7.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'll illustrate an example of this.
Just a second. Senator Hayden, did that answer?
Well, that's helpful. I'd like to hear your illustration, but that's helpful. I didn't know where you were going with that a little bit.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, some people who have been around to the legislature may know about the gang strike force. An out of element of that came with the use of GangNet. What happened is information was being retained on people without any kind of definition. Innocent people. Innocent people based on some associations. And when that came to light, that was thrown out, and there's issues being discussed about that. And that's one of the things I have some concerns about. You know, collection of information on people that we don't know for whatever reasons, and then being used in different kinds of situations. Criminal investigation data is a very defined term. It's people where you're basically preparing a case or investigating unknown or known persons. And that's where it's the importance of public scrutiny. And that some aspects of this, and there's history about this, as Madam Chair can tell you, you can be listed as a suspect very easily, particularly in another situation, because history is dictating my strong thing about this. 10 years ago, there was a computer database filed formed by the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association with the cooperation of all law enforcement, had millions of records on hundreds of thousands or maybe a million Minnesotans, and people were listed in all different kinds of ways, suspects, this, based on what the locals decided to implement their data, not what the standard. GangNet is another one. And so I hope the illustrations, and I don't want to take, but I can do it formally or informally as we do some of these things, but I just want to illustrate the aspect of that. One of the other things I think is important is that there needs to be clear public scrutiny of all these things. On the stationary fixed, there are some differences between the two. I have seen, and his across the country, of how surveillance is being used against certain segments of our communities in which we live in. It can be done discriminatorily, it can be done arbitrarily, and the way you see that it's not as happening is you get out as most as information as you can. On the Senate side, we're just talking about fixed cameras, for example. What you get is, to the extent possibly under Section 1337, which is security information. Now, someone who's dealt with the Act all these years, every law enforcement agency is going to say that. So if I'm trying to see if this new Dragnet technology is being used arbitrarily against segments of our community, which historically technology and law enforcement has, there'd be really no way to do that. So different kinds of language and details are very important. What I want to also focus on is the rest of the handout, which I think can be helpful to illustrate some of the important things and how language is important and some of the issues that I think. Because, Madam Chair, members of the committee, if there's going to be some type of retention, whether it be 14 days, 20 days, 45 days, or 90 days, there's going to have to be some work on strong, robust, detailed safeguards and policies, which on the Senate side are weak in some areas. And so that's where some of that kinds of things, and this is why some of the handouts are helpful to you. One that you have right here is just came out from May 1st. This was from Wired, which is a well-known website on technology and on issues like that. What comes into play here is how Vigilant Solutions across the country, a company that does provide service LPR technology, they go to law enforcement agencies, hey, you want to buy our stuff, whatever, come into play. They have a central database of 2 billion plus of license plate scans, and a lot of them are on innocent and law-abiding people. So the issue comes into play. When I found this out, I've started making data practices requests to agencies informally and discussion, and I don't get direct answers. The Vigilant Solutions website does list a number of agencies here in Minnesota that have some relationship with them. I do not know. But if you look at the article even more, you will see that they have non-disclosure agreements, that they don't want information to be discussed. Very similar to the issue of Harris Corporation and the issue with the BCA, which leads to why I think it's important for that first section of the bill that Senator Limmer is talking about. If you go through the handout, you'll see the four-page thing, as I indicated to you, about LPRs. Now, one of the important things, and Madam Chair, and I give credit to the Senate side for adopting this language, they basically have adopted what is known as the temporary classification. As you may know, Eric Roper, the Star Tribune, did a big story on LPRs. Did a focus on, I think it was 41 times, how Mayor Ryback was out throughout the city, and secondly, how he as a reporter was being, again, innocent, law-abiding people. And so we've got to keep this private, which I have no problem, some privacy, some aspects of this. But if you're going to have good public scrutiny and things like that, you need the public to be able to have access to that kinds of data. Now, the city of Minneapolis and law enforcement, basically, Minneapolis, when they did the temporary classification, they wanted a whole lot of stuff secret. So you couldn't really tell almost anything. You review their temporary classification and their application for it. The commissioner said, we're going to have certain things that are always going to be public. And that language is on the Senate side where it enunciates, I think, three... Madam Chair, if Mr. Guerin could just help me where that is. That's the three items. It says certain things that are private. Let's see on the Senate side. That's
Mr. Guerin?
No, there it is. It's on page R5, lines 211, 212, and 213. Now, this is one of the reasons why I think it's important, that a couple of handouts that I share with you. This is Minneapolis's, or St. Paul's, which is basically through 2013 LPR summary data. And again, this is some of the differences between law enforcement agencies. St. Paul focuses a lot on stolen cars. So you can see that they got 500 in the first 5 months of over 500,000 scams on innocent law-abiding people, and a certain percentage were on hits. Now, they particularly focus on stolen cars. They may put other people in or whatever, but this is what I got as a summary. Now, to compare that, on the list I shared with you, in 2011, Minneapolis had 3 million plus scams, and 0.068 were hits. Just a little bit over a half percent. Now, the other item you have here, this is from the city of Minneapolis. I got hundreds of pages of runs of scams. And this is why it's important, if there's going to be some buy-in by on the House side for some type of retention, that these kind of information be clearly public so that I can go and get the hits and see what the hits are, and I can sort of like see, this is currently what I've been getting generally public from many of the agencies because of the temporary classification, but I think it's important that it continue in law. So I can see how many hits they got on a certain day, and then I can ask the proverbial question, well, what did you do with the hits? Did you arrest them? Did you do this? Did you do that? Now with Minneapolis, Maplewood, and a couple other cities and entities, it's very hard to tell. That's why one of the things that I've suggested to some policymakers, if there's going to be a buy-in, that any stop or action of or on a vehicle based on an alert must be documented pursuant to Chapter 1382, which allows for information, for some information to be public. Like you get a ticket, you get a stop, you get logs, whatever. Now, Minneapolis currently and Maplewood said they couldn't tell me. They can't dig down. And I waited 7 months for that response, almost, from Minneapolis. Bloomington, they could. Mr. Neumeister, for the time period you asked for, which was about 4 weeks, we didn't arrest anybody or do anything with it. Could have been 3 weeks. But I asked, you know, I was going to ask for years and then have them do a lot of work. I could. But, you know, I'm someone who likes to take snapshots. And that's an issue that comes into play. You're gathering a lot of data, but I don't see where the accountability comes into play. The other aspect that you'll see the database here. You know, the next article is the whole issue. It was from the Tampa Tribune, is are we going to be using these LPRs at public events? Are we going to use them at churches and mosques and synagogues, which have been done in other communities? Are we going to be using them at political rallies? The Occupy Minnesota, where they have a entrance in and out. A group of people who believe it's in the Second Amendment. See, I'm one of both so both parties, you know, get this is important stuff. And so there's been discussion in other states, other legislatures, and other things about First Amendment activities, prohibition, the process, and those kinds of things. So with the illustration of the information that I have with you, I just want to now summarize on a couple points. And then I'd like to just give a handout to you. So if this is only one, the only copy I have, but you can have. What I did is broad points to keep in mind on LPR as you discuss some of these issues. And I like you can have that and copy it as you do some of the things. The unique thing that we are here historically, and I'm coming from decades of being involved intimately with legislators on policy matters when it comes into play here, is that this is the first time that the conference committee is really looking at the issue of dragnet technology, mass surveillance. This is where cheap technology, it's only cost a few thousand apiece, and the state is providing through the Department of Commerce. The state is funding a lot of these, also through Homeland Security, and also through cities and counties on doing these things, to scoop up personal data indiscriminately of where you go. It's and also the raw computing power. So what you do here at the conference committee will set a tone and model for the new technologies that are going to be coming. And remember, information is power, and anyone who holds a vast amount of data about us has power over us. Now, one of the things that I'll just take questions. I mean, I can go into more detail. Right. I've tried to give you a broad aspect and also very knowledgeable about the detail, what law enforcement is doing, and some of the issues that come into play.
Right, thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Are there any questions for Mr. Neumeister? All right, I guess not at this time. Okay. So we thank you for all your work and information that you've provided for the committee, and we'll take it into consideration. Representative Lesh.
Sure. I may have questions for Mr. Neumeister after we hear from some of the other testifiers, and you had stated that we're not going to complete this today. So, Mr. Neumeister, are you going to be around tomorrow in the
event? I will be, and I'll be here till about 9:15 or so.
Tonight. Well, I don't Madam Chair, I don't anticipate I'll have questions prior to that, but probably tomorrow or before tomorrow's hearing. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, anybody else like to testify?
Senator Limmer's here.
Senator Limmer, you can certainly join us at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't mind sitting out there with the people's chair out there either. I wanted to bring your attention to page R1. It was an amendment in the Senate language that I had proposed on the Senate floor. And it's raised a number of questions, especially from the law enforcement community of, well, basically, what are you trying to do, Limmer? And so I thought maybe you all might want to have at least a perspective of why I suggested we put this type of an amendment in this bill. As you know, we have had a history of relatively new revelations that law enforcement has been surveying through a variety of means, technical means, our citizens' traffic patterns, namely license plate readers. We've heard of the Kingfish scanning devices Many of these devices were used without the legislature even ever knowing they even had this equipment in their law enforcement agencies. I believe that the license plate reader had been purchased, at least the one in Minneapolis. If it hadn't been for an inquisitive reporter at the Star Tribune, we may not have known that they even had such a thing. I believe that the equipment had been purchased and had been used for over 6 years before a Star Tribune reporter had even reported the use of that equipment. We as a legislature, in a way, are kind of blinded by the lack of information of what type of equipment political subdivisions have. And if we are really the ultimate policy maker for the state of Minnesota regarding a whole host of issues, especially that of data privacy, I think we as a legislature should have a right to know what kind of equipment certain law enforcement agencies are buying as they try to accumulate and observe the actions of our citizens. Now, they may, and I'm sure they do, have legitimate reasons as they pursue individuals in the big fishbowl of all of our people. But then to, in their search, they, if there's no rules, they can continue to keep, hold, compare data on everyone else in that scan of information. Now, when I think about 6 years of unfettered regulation by any government agency spying on the traffic patterns of our citizens, I'm getting a little concerned. And I believe that we as a legislature should have an opportunity to know what kind of equipment is out there. You know, when you compare, and this is not really a condemnation of law enforcement, they have a difficult job. And they're trying to do it in a cost-effective way, their job, in trying to find bad guys that might be a threat to the rest of us. But when one of the challenges that we've had on any kind of issue on data privacy is that the data privacy issue is complicated simply because we have private sector industries that are continuing to just leap forward, quantum leaps in technology. And we, as a government, can't keep up. We don't know their capabilities. We don't know the newfangled invention that's now being created in some lab that can scan billions and billions of bits of information. And now it's getting to the point that you can put a camera or some device up in a hallway of an airport terminal, and you can scan faces from hundreds and thousands of feet away. There is even a suggestion that even drone devices 20,000 feet up in the air can target in on a specific Al-Qaeda target simply because of a facial recognition. Now, when you start thinking of that, and then if that keeps scanning to a wider and a wider and a wider field, pretty soon you're collecting lots of information, and if you do it over a long period of time, that information now is also getting to the point that it can not only define who, but what is the pattern of that individual's behavior, and where do they go, and where do they come from. We're living in a different world than even just a few short years away. I thought this amendment might at least, even though it may have been hastily written during the floor debate on the Senate floor, it certainly is worthy of a discussion now, perhaps an application either in a different format. But it's something that we should consider because I believe political subdivisions have lots of opportunities. Oftentimes they get federal loans at discount rates to get the new latest equipment, or it's a hand-me-down from the federal government, like some of the JRAPs that are now being, those are armored personnel carriers that are now becoming available from the U.S. military. These have anti-tank, or not anti-tank, anti improvised explosive device capability. It spreads the blast out to the sides rather than up into the vehicle. All good equipment, I'm sure, but I think maybe the legislature might want to know what political subdivisions are buying. Because quite honestly, there is more and more observation, and not necessarily in Minnesota so much, but we are beginning to militarize our local domestic police departments, whether we like it or not. And whether it's a real threat or a perceived threat, I can understand the policy discussion. But we in the legislature are removed from that. This focus for this discussion is really focused on the surveillance technology. And then what do we do with the data as we collect it? I thought this was a reminder to us that maybe what we should do is find out what equipment is out there, what are law enforcement using. I've asked, at least on the Kingfish device, two major law enforcement agencies in the state, DPS and Hennepin County. One of them claimed they have written policies regarding that, and the other one says, no, we don't have any written policies regarding that. So that raises another question. If you don't have written policies, if you don't have a standard operating procedure, well, then I guess anything could happen. These are just musings of me, but at the same time, I think these are serious issues, and when we're collecting data on citizens, especially in the event of the Minneapolis Police Department with license readers, and to accumulate data on citizens for 6 years and being exceptionally quiet about having that equipment, I think it should raise a caution flag to us as policymakers that we should determine what kind of equipment is actively being used in our state of Minnesota. It'll be used for prosecution. It'll be used for other things. I don't believe that law enforcement should just continually gather information on law-abiding citizens without any probable cause, and then just accumulate and accumulate under the premise that someone in that pool of information might someday break the law. I think we should wait for that probable cause determination and then give our police departments all of the equipment they need to do their job. If I can stand for any questions, Madam Chair, if there are any.
Senator Limmer, are there any questions for Senator Limmer? All right. Representative Lesch.
I have a question. Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, there was a pretty good explanation for the purposes of this, and I likewise think it's pretty important to get out front of this. It seems like every year we're playing catch-up on not just what the technology is, but far more important, the implications, constitutional implications for its use and storage. So I probably have questions for you about it, but I would like to hear law enforcement's perspective on what kind of problems this could cause for them prior to the questions that I have for you. So that's more of a statement, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lesch. Anybody else in the audience like to testify? I'm assuming we want to hear from law enforcement. I see ACLU. Step up. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mark Weigel. I'm with the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. I'm an inspector there. And do you want an introduction of who's with me also?
Certainly.
Madam Chair, members, Jeff Tate, Shakopee.
And my name is Scott Gerlicher. I'm the commander with the Minneapolis Police Department.
And could you state your last name again?
Sure, Gerlicher, G-E-R-L-I-C-H-E-R.
All right, thank you. Welcome.
Good morning. Just want to start out with the fact that listening to the previous testimony from Senator Limmer and Mr. Neumeister, that we don't disagree with much of what is being said here. Personally, I'm a Ben Franklin fan. I believe that government needs oversight. One of the things that I deal with at the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office is I help deal with civil litigation, and so I talk a great deal there about retention of data and that we need retention schedules and that it cannot be kept forever type of thing. We need to be very careful about that. That said, this bill is very, very important to us. We believe that license plate readers are a great tool for law enforcement and for our citizens to be able to do investigations. And the first thing that I need to point out is that the 90-day retention schedule is very, very important to law enforcement. We believe that that is something that is a great tool for us to be able to help solve crimes. And so that's very important. The second piece is the Senate language, and I can point to page R5, and it would be 2.9 through 3.2. That language, we are very supportive of that language because it goes into some of the things that we've been talking about here today, and like I said, that we in law enforcement are very supportive of. This language actually, we believe, tightens things up to a degree that other places around the country don't even have, that this would be hopefully one of the strongest laws within the United States, possibly even internationally. And it gives some protections. There is a trail. It does some guarantees to make sure that the data that is being accessed is being done so in a proper way. And again, like I said, that there is a trail. Some of the things that stick out in particular is that if there is reasonable suspicion, law enforcement gets some kind of an information that a license plate was used at the scene of a homicide, and so there's a reasonable suspicion to go in and look for that data. Only certain people within the organization are able to have that access. So an investigator wouldn't necessarily have that access. The investigator would have to go to somebody within the organization that would be the responsible authority. They would be either the chief, the sheriff, or a designee of that person. They would have training. So they know what a reasonable suspicion is. And then also, once they go in and access the data or check for that partial license plate or whatever it is that they're looking for, there would be a record that would be kept of that, and it would be needed that there would be a case number. So as we talk about an active investigation, there would be a case number, there would be a report that documents why that plate was being checked for. We believe that those kind of safeguards that are in this Senate language are very, very important, and we are very supportive of that.
Thank you. Sir, anything to add? Or
may I ask the testifier a question?
Certainly. Senator Champion.
To the testifier, can you break down for us, or maybe one of the other testifiers will do so, how you define, like, stationary versus stationary or fixed license plate readers, and license plate readers that you relocate from time to time, and I don't know what the technical term is for those, and how those are different from, let's say, a mobile license plate reader, just so that we can have a better sense of that, because that's one of the things that the chair asked me about, and how you define those license plate readers.
Inspector Regal.
Chair, Senator Champion, I'm going to let my cohort talk about that a little bit.
Go ahead.
Sure, Madam Chair and Senator Champion. In Minneapolis, as I think you alluded to, sir, we do have a couple of different bridges that have fixed license plate readers. To put it simply, those are fixed and mounted permanently on poles, whereas the units that we have, which, by the way, are four units total in the city of Minneapolis on police cars, marked police cars in the entire city. Those are mounted on police cars. They can be moved from one squad car to another. That's really the differentiation. Certainly, you could take those fixed units that are hardwired into a pole and move that, but that would take some doing, just like moving a street light to another location. I hope that maybe answers your question.
Senator Champion?
Yes, but I thought there was another license plate reader that is in between a fix and one that's mounted on a vehicle that may be, let's say, for an example, outside the airport, for an example, where, you know, it constantly, you know, reads license plates, but you can move that device from place to place. And am I wrong about that, or you don't have that capability?
Officer Gerlicher.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator, we don't have a system like that. They do exist. It'd be on a trailer or a type of vehicle. You may have a special event. You know, let's say we get the Super Bowl and we want to put a fixed license plate reader for a period of that week outside the new Viking Stadium. We could certainly do that. Whether that would be considered mobile or fixed, getting to that spot, it would be on wheels, but the effect would be the same.
All right. Senator Hall. All right. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and this may probably be, since this is Ramsey County, maybe I'd ask this of Inspector Weigel. If the vote on this bill was coming up, on Monday on the House floor, and you wanted to determine how many votes you had in favor of this measure or against it, and you parked a trailer with a license plate reader outside the SOB parking ramp to determine the identities of the votes you had coming in on that trailer to track the license plates of the legislators, would that be considered a fixed or a mobile reader?
Dr. Weigel.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I would believe I would consider that a fixed position.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's been a little while since I've been over here. Inspector Gerlicher, I was wondering about, so this, it was kind of going down the road of Senator Champion's question of the mounted hard wire on a pole versus the device that you put into a squad and can move from squad to squad. What about the trailers that we often see throughout the city? There might be high crime areas or something happens and you mount a trailer with the camera involved in that, then you take that. Is it just a surveillance camera, or could there be license, or are there license plate reader technology on that?
Officer Gerlicher.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, no, those are strictly public safety cameras in the city of Minneapolis. We have over 200 fixed public safety cameras mounted on poles throughout downtown and north and south Minneapolis. We also have 15 trailers you may have seen downtown. These are towed to a location. They're marked police. We put up the mast. It's got a camera. And then through our city's Wi-Fi system, we're able to monitor that. That's just visual public safety camera that does not have any ALPR capability.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So could there be that capability, the license plate reader, there if you found there to be a need? Is there ability for you to just mount the extra equipment on that trailer?
Officer Gerlicher.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I would think that would be a possibility depending on the wiring and the weight of the system, but certainly you could have a specialized trailer to have license plate readers, or potentially co-locate it with a camera system, a regular camera system. That's a possibility, certainly would exist, yes.
So, Madam Chair, just as a final statement, so there's kind of infinite possibilities that we could have depending upon the technology, and as the technology advances, that we could have kind of fixed, and then we could have them mounted, and we could have them on trailers. And I mean, it seems to me that that may not be your practice today, but there are those opportunities depending upon what the situation may be and what the technology looks like, where you could mount those on trailers or other things that, you know, I may not even know in order to get this information. Would you? I guess you don't have to comment on that. I guess that's more of a statement, Madam Chair. Just trying to get a sense of, I know in the communities that I represent, I see the trailers a lot, and I've always wondered kind of what is going on, what kind of data you're collecting, and what's happening, and the rationale for them to be there. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a few questions. One, the explanation was offered that in the Senate language there was some safeguards so that supervisors would ensure that not just anyone could go in and get this data for their proposal. But I will be honest, that still makes me somewhat nervous. The DNR employee who got busted for scanning thousands of pictures of women and saving hundreds on his computer illegally was a supervisor and in charge of compliance for the whole program. And so there are some gaps in safeguards, even in agencies where we have specific procedures in place. So I'm nervous about that. Additional safeguards beyond simply the law as it stands would you propose in your own policies that you write to ensure that there is no question that this cannot be done outside of the approved measures? And I would say this too, I mean, let's say this, what if it was the police chief, him or herself, that was doing this or accessing this illegally? What safeguards would there be in place for that eventuality?
Inspector?
Madam Chair and Representative, let me first state that law enforcement is still open to looking at this, and if there is some additional clarifying language that is suggested or that you would like, that we are certainly open to considering anything like that. Frankly, I don't know if there's ever a system that will ever be totally perfect. There's no way that we can say that there ever will be. So as you bring up a chief of police in a small department that does some kind of an abuse like that, I understand, and I understand your concern. We have also talked about audit here, too, so there is a little bit more of a system in place as far as that is concerned. In our agency, in the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office, like I said, we would have a system that would take place where the responsible authority would probably be the chief deputy, and the chief deputy would be the one that would say who are the people that would be able to access, and it would probably have to be a handful of people because of different schedules, that type of thing. Those people would have to go through training. Again, they would have to document whenever they are asked to access the system and why. They would have to be able to state that the reason why that they were being asked was substantial enough that they could go in there. The reasonable suspicion existed. When they accessed the data, there would be a trail of that. That information would be there. And then also a case number would have to be part of that trail. So there would be a report, basically, and it would be documented in a report. So there's numerous different safeguards that we're talking about building into this. And if you don't mind, if I can go back to your question from before. Obviously, the scenario that you were painting would be a situation where law enforcement would be overstepping their bounds in some way. And this system that we're talking about here is one of those that helps prevent that kind of thing. So it even if a license plate reader was parked outside of the parking ramp for the legislature, nobody can go in and access the data without a reasonable suspicion, and it is all documented. So if somebody does that, that's going to be on them. They're going to end up having to deal with the consequences, you know, whether that is any kind of action within the agency as far as you know, having to deal with them, disciplinary action. So I don't know if that answers that question from before, though, too.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, my question was a rhetorical question, of course. I have full confidence that none of the individuals sitting up at the table there would ever try something like that. But having worked as a prosecutor for going on 13 years now, I have met a small percentage of officers who perhaps wouldn't hesitate to do something like that if they thought it was in a certain interest, and that's what has me concerned. All it takes is one person to overstep the bounds, to really break down the confidence that the public has, and I really don't want us to ever go near that. If I could, Madam Chair, I would ask Officer Gerlicher, Lieutenant Commander? I'm sorry.
Commander, sir.
Commander Gerlicher. Because I never got this this information before, but prior to the distribution of the data, before the temporary agency designation through IPAD in 2012, what was the discussion in your department about the sensitivity of the information? When did it begin to come to light that this information was legally obtainable? And was there any action taken about that? Or was it just all of a sudden out of the blue you get a data practice request from the Star Tribune for 2 million records and there's a reaction to it? Was there discussion about this data prior to that time? And if so, what was that discussion?
Commander Gerlicher.
Madam Chair, Representative Les. My recollection of that is that there was some discussions about the data, but generally, until we received data practices requests, there wasn't any significant discussion. Certainly, we believe the data should be kept confidential, as a temporary classification is done in most cases. Our position, I think, is that, again, this is not data that we want the general public to have. It's sensitive data even within, in our opinion, law enforcement. And to kind of dovetail on that and what was said by Ramsey County here as well, maybe I could summarize for you some of the accountability measures we have in place already in Minneapolis. You may or may not be familiar with, to help kind of address some of those concerns with regards to access to the data, who can get it, etc. Right now, of the 800 sworn Minneapolis police officers, there's less than 20 people on our police department that have access to go in and pull out the type of data that we're talking about here today. Those are individuals that work for me up at our Strategic Information Center. In order to do this, you have to have the software on your computer. It's not a web-based system, contrary to some of the issues that have come forth in the past with DVS. You can't just be sitting at home, plug in your password, and obtain this data. You have to be at your city computer with the software activated, logging in through the secure network to our server to make an inquiry about a particular license plate. Now, within the city of Minneapolis, we use PIPS technology and BOSS as our back office software system. We took an extra step with our software in the city of Minneapolis so that anytime one of my staff wants to run a license plate for an investigative purpose, when they plug in the license plate number they want to run and they hit find, a dialog box pops up and they have to list what is your justification for running this license plate. And there's some pre-selected boxes, could be data practices, or could be case investigation, could be a number, three or four different options. And then there's some notes page, if you will, where they can put in per request from Sergeant Smith in the homicide unit, adding in a case number, All that information is recorded in the system. There's an audit trail so that we can pull up a report after the fact to see who's accessed that, how many times. Those are some accountability measures we put in place proactively that weren't necessarily part of the system that we purchased, but we did so because we want to have responsible policies and practices as well. Nobody likes to see some of the issues that have come up in the past with our other statewide databases. So it's a system that has very limited accessibility. All the individuals who access that have training not only how to use it, but also on the proper use of it. As you know, we have policies in place for the use of that. And there's an audit trail for us to determine who's accessed the data and why.
Madam Chair.
Chair Lesch.
Commander Gerlacher, did the City of Minneapolis at any time either receive or solicit an opinion from your city attorney on the proper use of this technology or the constitutionality of its application prior to putting it into service?
Commander Gerlacher.
I can't speak to that one way or the other. I was not involved at the time the initial purchase of this equipment was made. I know we've had extensive conversations with our city attorney's office since that time about the fact that, again, this type of information should be used for very strict investigative purposes. Again, the city of Minneapolis and myself personally worked with the city attorney and went to the state of Minnesota Department of Admin and got a state-approved retention schedule of 90 days, which is in place currently. So we have had a lot of dialogue with the city attorney, but my personal recollection doesn't go back. I, again, wasn't part of the initial purchase of the equipment when we got it.
Okay. Well,
Chair Lesch.
Madam Chair, and the reason I ask is I don't think you're alone, Commander Gerlacher, in being in a situation. You know, whether it's another law enforcement agency or even another government agency that has a new kind of technology they can place into the field, asking the questions about whether it could get out of hand, whether it's public under Chapter 13, or whether it's constitutional, isn't necessarily your wheelhouse. Your wheelhouse is catching bad guys, and if I was in your shoes, that's the same thing that I would do. But that's kind of why I think Senator Limmer's amendment that he talked about might be apropos here, because there are folks in this body and other locations that do think about that, and that's all they do. And we want to really, as much as is possible, minimize the number of situations where this technology gets out in front of us, so we're not doing consideration in retrospect and going to the city attorney afterwards, just because I am personally amazed at the level of complication that we have gotten to with respect to this technology and the things that we can do. I also wonder the justification at the front end, and I may consider this as well if I was an officer on the street, is, well, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy of your license plate. Therefore, we're good. But that's not the analysis. I mean, that may be the first blush analysis, but that is certainly not the analysis overall, because the analogy here we're talking about is not just happening to see a license plate as you're on patrol, but following someone around, effectively following someone around. And the Supreme Court alluded to that in U.S. v. Jones in January 2012. So that's U.S. v. Jones in January 2012. So that I want us, Madam Chair, to have more conversation about Senator Limmer's amendment, and I notice we don't have the other third member of the House side here. But if I could ask one more question at this point while we have law enforcement up here, is there, for any of you, is there a departmental policy regarding the use of HIT data? When you get a plate on the wrong car, registered owner comes back as revoked or suspended or canceled IPS, one of those situations that falls into the House language anyway, is there
Is there a required procedure that you have to follow with respect to being in receipt of that information? Or is at that point everything just simply officer's discretion?
Who wants to take it?
Madam Chair, members, anytime one of our officers gets a hit, as you mentioned, a revoked driver, for example, on a license plate read, they have to then go back and pull up additional information and confirm that that driver, because the LPRs are going to tell us who's driving that vehicle at that time, they have to go back, just as they would if they randomly ran a license plate, go back and then determine, does that driver match the physical description based on the registered owner, and take subsequent action whether or not that driver matched those physical descriptions.
Well,
Chair Lesh.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking is I could be wrong on this, but just based upon what I can see, now we don't have anyone here from St. Paul, but the information submitted by Mr. Neumeister suggests that there, in fact, was not very much follow-up at all on the hit data. So I'm trying to, and you can answer for St. Paul's data, and there's no one here from St. Paul. So I'm wondering if, for example, is it Chief Tate or, okay, Chief Tate, if I ran this data for Shakopee, would it show similar numbers? That there, in fact, is not significant follow-up at all on the hit data for your LPR plate images?
Chief Tate.
Madam Chair, members, I can give you an example of a recent, somewhat recent incident where one of our officers received a hit on a license plate from our reader, obtained additional information, pulled them over. The driver was revoked or suspended, had a warrant, something of that nature. By the time the officer had gone up, got the driver's license, checked for insurance information, come back to his car, he had seven more hits from vehicles going by. So there's seven hits that would show up on our, you know, if somebody were to go back in and look at how many hits you had versus how many non-hits you had. There's seven hits in there that are going to show absolutely no follow-up, for one example. Another example, to use, you know, some of the testimony earlier regarding an active order for protection. If I am driving and I get a hit, an alert that the registered owner has an active order for protection, there's only one person in the car. I don't need to do any more follow-up because there's no violation, whether or not the registered owner is the person driving or not. So that kind of information is officer discretion. There's no reason to go any further than just the alert. You have to do something extra to stop that individual or stop that vehicle.
Okay. No further questions at this time, Madam Chair.
I have a question about the designation of security data. We see it in the Senate language on page R6 at the end, let's see, like 315, 16, 17. And 5-6 years ago, I used to talk about the Mack truck exception of investigative data and how law enforcement could say that this was investigative data in order to keep it confidential and outside of the ability of the data subjects to access it. Now, the more recent trend or Mack truck exception that we're seeing is taking surveillance type data, large data sets, and I'll give an example. I don't know if it's still being applied this way, but data collected at the Mall of America being shared with the Bloomington Police Department in blanket form being classified as security data as a condition of the sharing back and forth between security entities at the Mall of America and turning then their information not governed by the Data Practices Act to the Bloomington Police Department. And so as I look at the language that the Senate has around location of these of these readers, I can see an instance where all locations could easily be defined as security data, and hence you wouldn't have any disclosure. Can you give me examples of locations of readers that would not be security data?
Madam Chair, if I could ask for a little bit of help from one of my colleagues here.
We allow phone a friend here.
Thank you very much.
But it does, we'll see who's going to answer the phone here. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
My name is Drew Evans. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Madam Chair. Members, I think that's a valid question. I think that we're looking at security information data classification, that we try to use that very sparingly. It would really, I hate to use the word depend, but it would depend on the actual location of the reader and what the purpose of that reader would be. If it would provide information that would compromise the security of our citizens, there might be a situation where we would. But we've had this discussion within the Department of Public Safety. We would like to use security information declarations very sparingly, and for the reason that you stated, that it's not overused to protect data that shouldn't be protected, that should be designated as public or retain its classification under the Data Practices Act. To just further illustrate that point a little bit, I think it goes to some of the questions Senator Champion had concerning fixed versus stationary versus mobile technology. I do think there's a difference between all three. When I consider fixed location, I think it's a situation as was described that would be very difficult to move, such as being affixed to a bridge deck where that is more of or less a relatively permanent location, as opposed to something that we're on a trailer or mounted in a situation that would be deployed where we have significant security concerns, such as a high-risk security event or part of an active criminal investigation. And so I think it would really depend on how that LPR is being used in the given context.
Well, you haven't really made me feel any better, because you talk about how you'd like to see this security classification used sparingly, but I think the use of this is exploding as a classification. And it's not all... I don't fault law enforcement, because quite frankly, we at the legislature have struggled with having appropriate classifications of how we deal with surveillance data in general. You see the license plate reader bill before us, which is a subset or a component of surveillance data in a very high-tech fashion, but we also have surveillance data in a very low-tech fashion that's collected on individuals, suppositions, some of the gang net things that we saw with police, public safety, collecting information on affiliations or places that people went, etc., law-abiding people, that was then stored in electronic databases for access. So I don't bring this in an effort to badger or cause problems. I'm raising it as an issue because what used to raise concerns when I would see investigative data, again, recently using security data as a classification, it makes me nervous, because I think that it's just a broad exception, and even by your testimony, a high security event to bring in a mobile unit, as I look at the Senate language around location of that technology, my guess is that at first blush, law enforcement would deem the location of that mobile unit at a high security event as security information and not disclose its use. And so I don't know if we have to look at language that says, you know, within 10 days after event is over, or, I mean, I don't know where we go with this, but just for the Senate, I know what you're trying to accomplish, but I'm not comfortable with the language as it sits, because I think there's a lot of room for abuse of that. So any other questions of the gentlemen that are at the table? The House goes in at 10. By a show of hands, can I see how many more people want to testify on this bill so I can, for time purposes, kind of... Okay. Chair Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the House bill says has 0 days retention, which solves our problem. And we're talking about two different data sets here, the hit data, which you talked about, and the non-hit data. And the House's major issue last year related, there are a whole series of questions that should be asked with respect to the hit data, how it's used, and everything like that. And the analysis is very similar.
Very similar to the analysis that we use for normal investigations, because you got your reasonable suspicion, at which point you'll have your probable cause. The non-hit data is another issue entirely, and it is relatively a new analysis. The House language states you can't use it, you can't retain it. The Senate language is very different to the extent that, well, yeah, you can use it as long as someone's supervising you in the police department. And this, I think, I can't think of a situation where we've done something like this similar, and maybe those testifying can correct me on that. But it is the desire of the of law enforcement to make use of this data set for folks upon which you currently have no reasonable suspicion or probable cause. Therefore, normally in that situation, under the typical other analysis of a law enforcement investigation, we would say, okay, well, in order to investigate that person, you got to get a warrant. What is wrong with a law enforcement agency for going into that data set of individuals who are innocent because they have not been proven guilty? What is wrong with going outside the department? This would alleviate a problem similar to the DNR issue. Going outside the department to a judge who signs off on your explanation. Because as it stands right now, your requirement of having an existing case file, case number, and investigation would still be within the department, and we'd run into those same administrative issues that we've had with the DNR and other government agencies where this data safety becomes incredibly porous and causes problems for us. What's wrong with getting a warrant for this?
Commander?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lesh. Again, the data that we're talking about is data that's taking place on public streets. Therefore, it really doesn't fit the criteria for getting a warrant, which is going into someone's house or onto their property. So in the law as it is written today, it really doesn't match. But to give you an example of how valuable, you've heard all sorts of examples, I'm sure, of the value of the non-hit data. And to us in the Minneapolis Police Department, the non-hit data is of extreme value to us. And just to give you a brief example, I was a homicide detective, so we get a shooting north Minneapolis. Let's say it's a particularly vicious shooting. We have a kid that's killed. Okay, so I'm a homicide detective. I go to the scene of that north Minneapolis. One of the things that I do as a detective is I ask the responding officers, I want you to canvass the area. So I ask the officers to go from house to talk to individuals. I ask them to walk up and down the block to write down the license plates of every vehicle parked on that block or within a certain area. That is data that's out there available. That's data that may and very well could prove and has proven useful after the fact in the case of a homicide. With the case of a license plate reader system, this is now we're able to do this in a much more effective and quick method. So we have the same situation now, a homicide taking place in North Minneapolis. Now I can dispatch one of my squad cars that's equipped with a license plate reader. All they have to do is drive up and down the streets in a 3 or 4 block grid pattern. They've now captured photographs and license plates of every vehicle parked within that particular area. So why is that of value? It may be of no value today, but my people aren't going in and querying and looking at every vehicle that was parked there. What they're doing is, after the fact, 30 days, 60 days, however long after, you may develop a suspect. Maybe as part of that, the suspect, you know, you have somebody pointing to the fact that he was in the area, they saw him with a gun. You get him in custody, you're doing an interrogation of the suspect. He says, that wasn't me. I was in an area. I wasn't even near there. Oh, really? Well, now we have a license plate of his vehicle that may have been parked a half a block away at the time of that homicide. That's just a hypothetical example of the type of value that the non-hit data can provide to law enforcement. It's been proven time and time again in Minneapolis, in St. Paul, across the country, and that non-hit data, retaining it for a reasonable period of time, is critical to law enforcement. Without having any retention in the non-hit data, the effectiveness of this tool goes way down.
Chair Lesh.
I'm wondering if the other, if Chief Tate could maybe give an answer.
Chief Tate.
Madam Chair. Why no warrant?
Members, I would concur with the commander's comments that, I mean, this is a photograph of a license plate on a public road. In terms of getting a warrant, that I believe that's public information that we could obtain. We have similar examples where we've had in the last 12 months two homicides in the city of Shakopee. For a city our size and strength of our office, our staff, we're not going to be able to get all that information within 24 hours. We need that retention period for this data. Once you start talking to suspects and you find out, well, oftentimes they're not driving a vehicle registered to them, it's somebody else's, it may be a girlfriend's. And oftentimes, the few times we have gone back in and run a plate to see if we've come across it at a specific area, it's been because we've obtained information after the fact, 48 hours or so after a major case.
Okay, Madam Chair. So what I heard from Commander Gerlacher and Chief Tate is two things. Number one, it's not the same thing as a warrant, because this is an image of a plate on a street. And number two, that it's really useful to solve crimes. And let me ask one other question of Commander Gerlacher. Commander Gerlacher, what would be the cost? What would have been the cost to the City of Minneapolis Police Department in terms of labor and resources to collect 2 million license plate images in June of 2012 without the technology? What would it have cost you to have police on the street to write down all those plate images and aggregate them into a database?
Commander.
Madam Chair, Representative Lutz, I would imagine to try to go and handwrite all those plates would be very significant cost. You can't put a number to that. I'd be uncomfortable doing that, but obviously I think the question answers itself. It would be extremely labor-intensive process and an expensive process to do that.
Madam Chair, Commander Gerlacher, would it have even been fiscally in any way possible for the Minneapolis PD to do that?
Commander Gerlacher.
Madam Chair, Representative Les, probably not, no.
Thank you. So two things, I guess, in response to both of those responses, that it's really useful to solve crimes. I have no reason to doubt you whatsoever. I'll bet there are ways that this is useful that we haven't even imagined yet. And just the ways that you describe of how useful it is, I absolutely believe you. But there are other ways, the other things that we could do to citizens that would be useful to solve crimes too. We could microchip everybody, and that would be incredibly useful in solving crimes. We could track them down, find out who they're talking to at any given point. It would be a phenomenal tool to fight crime. But there are reasons that we don't do that, at least now. the second thing is that you say that it's not the same as a warrant, because a warrant is like walking into someone's house or invading their privacy, their reasonable expectation of privacy. And so I would ask some other rhetorical questions on this point, but I'm not going to. I'm just kind of going to explain. If you, Commander Gerlacher, for example, have internet at your home, you certainly probably would have a reasonable expectation that is private. But what about the person
who, let's say, doesn't secure their Wi-Fi network with a password. Anyone can come by and hop on that Wi-Fi hotspot and find out which websites they've been going to. A police officer could go by and park their car outside that person's house and hop on their Wi-Fi network and find out what websites they've been visiting. Now, the normal person in a house expects that their internet traffic is not being followed everywhere they go. Yet at the same time, they wouldn't necessarily have a reasonable expectation of privacy if they didn't put a security password on their Wi-Fi network. But if you told the average person out there, well, hang on a second, I'm a police officer, your Wi-Fi network's open for anyone to see, you should have known better. Well, it's like telling the average person, you should have known better. You could look at your license plate anywhere you went, so therefore we have the ability to track where you go, who you've, what locations you've been to, how often you go there, whether you go, like the Supreme Court has said, whether you go to church, whether you go to synagogue, whether you go to a massage parlor in downtown Minneapolis, whether you're a late-night clubber. All this kind of information the Supreme Court has said is not necessarily information that's in the public interest. This is why I think it's really important that we talk about this, and I think we're going to have a disagreement that it's not the same as a warrant. And I think the Supreme Court has said that as well. So I'd like us, Madam Chair, to kind of have a more open discussion about that. It's what's being talked about nationally right now. I fully understand law enforcement's perspective on that. And, in fact, if I was sitting in the boots of these gentlemen up there, I'm sure I would say the same thing. But I'm saying something different now because I'm on this side of the table, so I hope we can address that when other people are at the table as well.
All right, thank you, Chair Lesh. And given that we got at least three more people who want to testify on floor session in 22 minutes, I think we'll take more testimony. And
Madam Chair, can I just...
Sure, Senator Hayden.
Well, and maybe this isn't just the right time, and I don't know if the law enforcement folks will be back as we do this, but I guess the question I would ask or would want to get a response from you guys is that there's this kind of hypothetical theme, and so I haven't engaged in this as much as some of my esteemed colleagues here, and most certainly the chair of our committee and others that have really thought about this a lot. So I come at it kind of broader and much more as a neophyte. But there's this underlying hypothetical, Madam Chair, of, well, something like we got the information, and then something, if something happens, then we could use it to figure out what that might be. Or, you know, Commander, you said somebody gets shot in North Minneapolis, and that we, you know, kind of canvass this, and then at some point if we catch somebody, we could kind of go back, grab the data to see if they're in the area. Can you guys give me a sense of how many, or in general, how many crimes you have solved using, you know, beyond the hit data, the revocation and that kind of stuff, but how many crimes do you solve using this technology? Because what I hear is this infinite possibility that we could do it if everything lines up. But really, how useful has it been in solving crimes that have happened in your respective cities?
Commander?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Hayden. I can't put a number on it. It's not a daily occurrence where this tool by any means is solving crimes. I did bring with a couple examples that I'd be happy to share with anybody. In one case, that it solved a homicide. Another, it solved a burglary case through the use of ALPR. But to put a number on it, you know, is difficult sitting here right now. I would say that in a dozen range, dozens in the past year or two that I've been part of the in my position.
So Madam Chair, for time's sake, I just really think that that's helpful, because what I'm trying to weigh as we start to get into the details of this is, and I think the larger issue is, you know, this idea of how much intrusion do we put on citizens, and how much do we follow them, and how much data do we collect versus what we get in return from a public safety standpoint. And then we, as legislators, have to kind of weigh that and put some parameters. And so I think it's helpful as you guys, and I do appreciate this, the seat that you're in and the great work that you do to keep us all safe. But I do think that it is important for us to get an understanding of, you know, I think Mr. Neumeister and others talked about the local civilian law enforcement, or what I'm saying, non-military, being more militarized in terms of what we do and how much surveillance we have on people and what the threat is out there so that we can all be safe. And I think it's really helpful if you guys do return, or as we have further conversations, Madam Chair, that we really drill down there a little bit for me, because that's what I'm trying to get my arms around is, you know, how do we use it? And I do, Commander, think about this a lot, because there's plenty of those trailers that pop up in my district, and I always kind of wonder why. Like, I always think something must have happened, but maybe that's not always the case. And then I always want to know, like, well, what are they collecting and why, and then how has that helped you keep the peace? So I just think that that's really important, Madam Chair, as we think about this issue.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Gentlemen, maybe a little homework. So at this point, we're going to move on to other testifiers. Mr. Gamberling?
Madam Chair, could I share just a couple of real quick concerns? I'll take 2 minutes just on DPS's perspective on just a couple provisions.
Would you like certainly.
The couple provisions that we just wanted to raise from the Department of Public Safety are a couple of them. Number one being the inventory of surveillance technology. I just want to raise for the members to consider. We certainly understand. I listened to Senator Limmer's intent behind this amendment. As written, it is extremely broad, and we have significant concerns with that particular provision as to what that would mean if that information was public on disclosing every piece of our surveillance technology. And in particular, I'd be very concerned for the safety of my agents and confidential informants and other persons in relation to that. The intent behind it is understandable. We'd just like to have continued discussions. Representative Lesch offered a amendment that he pulled on a technology committee, and that is our concern, that information will be public. I don't think that we have concerns about informing our legislature, obviously, on the tools that we're utilizing and how we're utilizing them. I'd be concerned, though, for the safety of our officers, our agents throughout the state, if that was a public document that was published on surveillance technologies. The second item is in the Senate language, I believe it's on page R5, the Senate language concerning the audits. It indicates the Department of Public Safety will conduct the audits of these systems. I just want to raise for the members that this is something that is obviously needed, that audits need to be conducted, these systems. However, these are generally right now proprietary systems that are purchased and owned by local law enforcement throughout the state. We do a significant number of audits, but we audit our systems that we own at the BCA. And in order for it to be meaningful, we don't have the ability currently to audit those systems. And so we would believe it'd be more meaningful for the local agencies to conduct those audits. And then lastly, I do agree with the provisions we've talked about. Perhaps defining fixed versus stationary versus mobile might be helpful, and that different data classifications may be considered, as you've discussed, Madam Chair, so that we do not use overuse security information, that we specifically classify the data related to those three different technologies, perhaps in different mechanisms. Stationary, if you were as part of an active criminal investigation, there may be a need not to disclose the location of that. However, a fixed device, I can see the value in having that as a public information and posting which agencies possess these devices. We've had conversations with the Safe at Home program at the Secretary of State's office. Their indication is they just want to know which agencies possess these devices so that participants in that program can contact those agencies, not necessarily know the fixed location of each of these devices.
All right, just real quickly, as long as you opened it up, do you believe that law enforcement has the authority to sign non-disclosure agreements while related to the technology that they purchase and employ?
I will answer the question, Madam Chair. I didn't intend to open that up, but we do have non-disclosure agreements related to some of our technology. Typically, the non-disclosure agreements revolve around proprietary information by the companies that they are trying to protect protect their particular technology in a given field.
you didn't exactly answer my question. Do you believe law enforcement has the authority to sign non-disclosure agreements when they're purchasing or deploying technology?
I think law enforcement, not just necessarily technology, we do sign non-disclosure agreements and believe we have the authority to with a variety of technologies that we employ, not necessarily surveillance technologies or limited to surveillance technologies.
And what authority then do you believe you have to sign non-disclosure?
I think it's inherent in our authority as a executive branch agencies to enter into contracts with various companies we are contracting with for a variety of services, whichever it may be. However, I would tend to agree that then we need to examine those non-disclosure agreements in relation to the Data Practices Act and that it continues to apply even in relation to our non-disclosure agreements that we may have.
Well, and the premise is that all contracts are public, and we see this proliferation now of law enforcement signing non-disclosure agreements when they're purchasing or using various technologies, and they haven't, at least in my mind, done a very good job explaining where their authority is to make a certain contract, some in their entirety, unavailable for public scrutiny. I expect that we might be going down the security data black hole if we push for an explanation. Current law allows for trade secrets and other items to be not disclosed, but it looks like we have this trend now, and I'm just curious what your thoughts on that are, because we're trying to get sunshine into this whole thing, and at every turn we find that law enforcement is in many instances for good reason using portions of the data practices law that were never put into place for these purposes. They're hanging their hats, if you will, on security data or cookie language or all these kind of really weird twists and turns of Chapter 13, and I don't think it's serving anybody's purposes very well. And so as we're working through kind of this issue, I'm trying to get your perspective on where these lines should be as far as public need to know and disclosure
I would agree with you, Madam Chair, that the contracts continue to be public information unless one of the various provisions of the Data Practices Act applies. We haven't used that in terms of some of our surveillance technology. I think probably what you're referring to is our cellular exploitation technology, in which we've held back some of the information related to that. And we've used the deliberative process provision of the Data Practices Act in that situation and the trade secret information for various portions of that. However, we've answered many questions related to that technology that we could, and we've tried to go through very specifically and release the information we could on that particular technology without compromising the integrity of that and protecting the safety of Minnesotans while we use that technology.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Mr. Gamberling. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Gamberling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Gimberling. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information, which is dedicated to government accountability, sunshine, transparency, etc. I know most everybody at the table pretty well except for Senator Hayden and Senator Champion. My state career can be divided into two parts. I worked for the state for about 36 years. I spent 5 years working on criminal justice information systems. That was my first real job. I taught cops how to use those systems. Okay? I helped design those systems. I wrote training manuals. I spent a lot of time with law enforcement. The balance of my career was spent working with issues of fair information practices, which is the derivation of the name of the Data Practices Act, and issues of government accountability through Sunshine, Freedom of Information. Okay? In that role, I spent a lot of time training government agencies, including law enforcement, on how to comply with the statutes and how to deal with difficult issues. That's my background. That's my professional background. My personal background is one of a person who's been politically active for years, active in the anti-war movement, active in the civil rights movement, and who's been surveilled by the government on occasions. Okay? And I like to think I was always surveilled when I was carrying on lawful activities like exercising my rights under the First Amendment. As you can probably tell, I have some strong feelings about these issues. Okay? What you're looking at with these kinds of bills is the latest iteration in a discussion that's been going on in this country, particularly since the late 1960s, on how you control bad actors in the government. Okay? I agree with much of what you've said and much of what the folks who appeared at this table before me have said about, you know, there are a lot of good guys out there. I like to think most people in law enforcement are good guys. But the question always is, what do you do about the bad guys? And we have a history of bad guys. Okay? I won't take you back to 1966 and earlier, because you can go back a lot earlier to things like red squads in police departments who spent a major amount of time not keeping an eye on communists, but keeping an eye on labor leaders like Walter Reuther, the president of the United Auto Workers. So the question is always going to be, how do you control bad behavior? Well, in Minnesota, you passed a law back in 1974 called the Data Privacy Law. Okay? And it was based on some principles developed by a high-level panel of people whose whole idea was to find some ways of making organizations accountable for the information they collect and use on people. Okay? Now, one of those principles, and it's relative to part of what you're talking about today, is a principle that says we should never have information systems that are totally secret, that nobody even knows about. And why was that principle established? Because we had a history of information systems developed at the federal level and other levels of keeping information secret from the public. And what do we know about secrecy? Secrecy promotes excess, and it often promotes corruption. Okay? So what you did is you put some things in the Data Practices Act to limit the secrecy that's possible. And part of what I'm always amazed at after all the years I've been doing this is having people come up here, and it's not a new issue to me, and tell you that they have only very recently put into place some policies and procedures that they've been required to put into place for years and years and years. Okay? So part of what you're trying to do, I think, and what I hope you're trying to do, is you're trying to focus attention on these things. Because attention not only helps you make policy, but it helps bring about changes in people's behavior. Okay? I'll give you an example. Senator Limmer's amendment on the Senate floor to essentially require an inventory of surveillance technology. If you go into the Data Practices Act and its implementing rules, you'll find that there's a requirement that government agencies list all of the data that they collect and maintain on people that they regard as not public in an inventory. And that inventory was first required in 1980. An update to that inventory is required every year under statute. And I suspect if you go from agency to agency, particularly law enforcement agencies, you'll find very few of those inventories that are in place, and you'll find even fewer that are up to date. Okay? What's the purpose of the inventory? It's to make sure we don't have any secret systems. Okay? Your thought was, if we give visibility to this stuff, then people will react to its existence. Okay? But if government agencies don't do what they're supposed to do, then, and as some of you know, and I won't get my broken record speech, the ultimate issue always is, how do you get compliance? Okay? I appreciated Representative Lesch's questions about what was the mental process that the Minneapolis Police Department went through when they put this system into place and began using it. Okay? Now, Senator Limmer says that was for 6 years, and I don't know how long it was. I know it was at least 2 or 3 years. And then suddenly, because a reporter comes in and says, so I understand you got this database, can I look at it? Suddenly there's this whole flurry of activity and people are all focused on, well, we can't have this out going out to the public. It was already going out to the public because it was public under the Data Practices Act. And that produced the application for temporary classification. So What I hope you do in all of this stuff is find better ways to get them to pay attention to your policy, okay? Because part of my job, as I saw it when I worked for the state, was this is your policy. You are the people's elected representatives. A bureaucrat like me, a police chief, other people like that, you know, we're the instruments of your will, as it were, okay? We carry out your policy because you get elected to make the policy. And so the more scrutiny you can give to these issues, the better off things are going to be, okay? Now, I have some detailed issues, and I can share them with you at some other time, but there's a lot of good things in both these bills, but I see some technical problems, and I always find it hard to get out of the role of the technician person who looks at the little pieces and says, for example, quick example, you got this report on surveillance technology from Senator Limmer that goes to the chairs in the committees. Well, what you want to do for sure is amend that, if you keep it, to make sure that report goes to the new Data Practices Commission, okay? That was signed into law by the governor, and congratulations, Representative Holberg, and other people who worked on it. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But in summary, as you put things in this bill, or you keep things in this bill, that focus on things like policies and procedures within an agency to make sure that your policy, public policy that you want to carry out is obtained, keep in mind, there's got to be some way to do that. There's got to be some way to check on that. And when I hear law enforcement agencies say, well, the best way to do this is to have them audit themselves, I get real problems with that. There's a wonderful Latin phrase, and I'm no good at Latin. I barely graduated from college because I was no good at languages. And I can't do it in Latin. It's much better in Latin. But you've all heard this phrase, I think. The phrase goes something like this. Who guards the guards themselves? Okay? It was a comment by a Latin scholar about the Praetorian Guard in ancient Rome, which, after being created to protect the empire, turned into a political organization that essentially decided who the emperor was, and when they didn't like something the emperor did, they killed him off. Okay? So what you're really thinking about and talking about here, and I commend your efforts, is who guards the guards themselves, and who does that in the most effective way possible. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Gamberling? All right, thank you.
Are you coming back here?
It wasn't our intent that we would reconvene if we can get a testimony done this morning.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee, if you'll state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feist. I'm legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I'll keep my comments very brief this morning. I believe most of the points that I was going to bring up have been brought up either by the committee members themselves or through the other testifiers. I simply want to be on the record that the ACLU of Minnesota supports the House position on the principled basis that we don't believe you should be keeping data on innocent individuals just in case they do something wrong in the future. To the extent that we are getting away from that and that a compromise is reached where there is a period of retention, we believe that judicial oversight really makes sense as the way to make sure that this sensitive information is protected. We've had conversations with law enforcement, and I believe that they have acted in good faith to try to work out some of these issues so far, and I hope that they will continue to do so. But with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Chair Lesh.
I have a question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr. Feist, we've heard reliably from law enforcement, including from Mr. Gerlacher and from Commander Gerlacher and Chief Tate, that this data does not fall under the protections afforded by the Fourth Amendment because there's no reasonable expectation of privacy. And that's fine. Like I said, if I was in their shoes, I'd probably toe that line as well. But
In reality, one thing we have not heard is a comprehensive legal argument from your opponents, their legal opponents at least, saying no. Now, I've read the Supreme Court decisions on this point, and I think the Supreme Court, in my opinion, is pretty clear saying no, it's not the same thing. Seeing a license plate and then using technology to track everywhere it goes in town are two different things. But is there anyone who could advise this conference committee on law enforcement's legal defense of that? Because I think that opinion would be something that would be important for us to hear from. Do you know of anyone who could provide this committee with that?
Mr. Feist.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, to my knowledge, I haven't heard of anyone who'd be willing to step forward on that position. I agree with your comments that both the Supreme Court and U.S. v. Jones and the fact that we now have this new technology that is really changing the rules of the game that we have lived with for a long time in this area means that this needs to be figured out nationally, and we can do something about it here in Minnesota, which is very exciting and I think very appropriate. But in terms of going back to your question, I have not heard or I'm not aware of anyone from that side that can support their position right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and you know, as these committees are, a lot of times I don't think of something, you know, until we're talking about it in the middle of it, but it occurs to me that I think that'd be pretty important. I'm sure there's a county attorney somewhere that's in Minnesota who's done this research and maintains it, and no one's just going to rest on the laurels of the status quo. But I don't think in the years that this body has looked at this issue that I've really heard a solid legal defense of the status quo. So I just wanted to put that out there, that I don't want to come up with a policy between the House and Senate what they're doing, and then, you know, all of a sudden find out the trending legal opinion, and, you know, makes us wrong. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? All right, looks like thank you, Mr. Feist, Ms. Frazier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Frazier, the Deputy Secretary of State. And we have worked with the authors of the bill on both sides, as well as Representative Lesch, and really appreciate you all taking Safe at Home and the needs of the Safe at Home participants into account. We've also had some really great conversations with the law enforcement community and really appreciate their working with us over the past several months on this issue and making sure that there can be protections for Safe at Home. And so we appreciate that there are protections in both the Senate file and the House file in front of you for Safe at Home participants. The House file, because data is destroyed immediately as long as it's not a hit. And the Senate file, because it allows for a Safe at Home participant to submit a notice that they are in Safe at Home and the data should be immediately destroyed as long as it's not a hit. One of the things that we want to bring to your attention is what if it is a hit? And wanting to be sure that the House language, for example, in 4.26 says that automated license plate reader data are private data on individuals and may only be retained if, for example, a car has been stolen. So one of the things we've realized a little bit later in the process is, so if there's joint ownership of a vehicle and, you know, one person has taken the vehicle and left, that the other person could report it stolen, and then it would be, the data would be retained, and since it's joint ownership, the person who wants to find the other person could then receive the data, say, oh, it's my data because it's my vehicle, I want to know where it's been. And so that's one thing we're concerned about, is what is the classification of the data if it is retained, and wanting to be sure that at least for participants in Safe at Home that it's confidential, which means that a subject of the data does not have a right to access of that data. I think that folks involved, Advocates for Battered Women, may have concerns about that more generally, but of course our primary concern is participants in Safe at Home specifically. So I just wanted to raise that issue and, again, appreciate working with law enforcement. We have had some conversations about the possibility of creating a hit list of Safe at Home participants who have submitted notices, so which would make it easier for local law enforcement, because then it would just be one of the databases that it's run against, and they would know it needs to be automatically deleted, as opposed to each individual local law enforcement agency having to figure out how to work with their vendors to delete the data. But it looks like the language in the bill, in the Senate bill, would allow for either it to be deleted at the local level or at a state level. So I'm happy to answer any questions and appreciate your time.
Any questions for Ms. Frazier? All right, thank you. Anybody else like to testify before we adjourn this morning? And I didn't make it clear at the beginning of the meeting, but the House File 183 language that's in this bill is being conferred in another conference committee. So this conference committee will just work on the license plate reader data issue. So with that, we're adjourned.